Welcome, everyone, to a bonus episode of Undisclosed. This week's sponsor is longtime friend of the show, Stamps.com. Make sure you listen in for Stamp Spot later in the show and support Stamps because Stamps supports us. Until then, enjoy the program.
In 1997, Joe Tash was murdered in Trout Creek, Montana. His best friend, Richard Rogest, was convicted and sentenced to life plus 10 years in prison, largely based on the testimony of a man named Rory Ross. Ross claimed that, on the night of the murder, he'd been hanging out with both Rogest and Tash, and after they'd gone back to the campsite to continue their party, Rogest had shot his friend. Ross did call 911 and reported that Joe Tash had been killed and that Rogest had done it. And within a few hours, Rogest had been arrested. He was in prison from then until December 2015, when a court found that the state had committed an unintentional Brady violation, that a cop had witnessed an event that matched perfectly with the alibi Rogest maintained since 1997. This cop's statement, though, wasn't discovered until a few years ago, when an investigator with the Montana Innocence Project interviewed him. Rogest had had previous appeals, but they were all denied. In one, after Rogest had tried to introduce evidence that Rory Ross had himself confessed to Joe Tash's murder, the prosecutor opposed Rogest's motion, stating that nothing Ross said could be relied upon because, quote, even if Ross's alleged confession were new evidence, the mumblings of a drunk town drunk has absolutely no reliability. It was not until his 2013 motion, in which the Montana Innocence Project raised the Brady claim, that headway was finally made on Richard's case. I first heard from Richard's attorney, Brett Chandelson, over a year ago now. Brett had been volunteering on Richard's case since 2013, and in November 2015, he sent me an email to alert us to the new court order that had come out, overturning Richard's conviction. Brett and I started emailing back and forth, and I asked if he and Richard would be willing to sit down for an interview sometime. He said yes, they'd love to, but we decided it'd be best to wait until after the charges against Richard were dismissed, so as not to have to worry about discussing anything in an interview that could affect the retrial if it happened. Finally, in August of this year, Montana announced that it would be dismissing the case. Richard would not be retried for his friend's murder. I spoke to Richard and Brett about a month after the charges were dismissed against Richard once and for all, and just before Richard moved out of Montana. So I guess we should start at the beginning. What was your understanding of the state's case when you were charged?
Well, they had some bogus charges and they were running with them. That's really all I understood, actually. I mean, there wasn't much else to understand, you know, besides malicious prosecution and them not investigating properly and things like that, you know, which a lot of the investigation stuff came out towards the end or since the trial with some private investigation companies my sister hired, and then the Innocence Project had several different investigators looking into things, and so there's been a whole bunch of new stuff that came up that was never at the first trial.
Who was the victim in your case?
My buddy Joe Tash. I knew him since I was 12 years old.
How'd you end up learning of his death?
Well, I was at a job site remodeling some trailers, and I was cleaning up some tools to go to the owner's house for lunch, and next thing you know, there's four or five cops all around the trailer I was working on and guns drawn. And that's about, I don't know, a minute after that is when one of them told me. So it was pretty shocking, actually.
Were you a suspect right away or did that not happen till later?
You were the only suspect at the time. I mean, and when he says they showed up and arrested him about 7 hours after the murder took place. There was no real investigation before they arrested him at all.
One guy at the scene of the crime, Rory Ross, they didn't take his clothes.
No GSR, no fingerprints.
Right, right.
They didn't collect the bloody clothes that he was in.
So one guy ID'd you, and that was it?
Yeah.
And they just ran with that?
Yeah, they ran with that. And then when I stayed in town, there was another guy. He said I didn't, but subsequently, he told his brother in prison, who had been doing one or two life sentences for something that this guy that I spent the nights at his house, set up another homicide like 11 months before the one where my buddy got killed. And his brother gave one of my investigators a 38-page affidavit saying how he told him I was there. I spent the night at his house. He and this other guy did it. I mean, it just laid it out real good because the guy was dying and he wanted to get his stuff right.
Yeah. What he's trying to explain is that at the time he was arrested, it was based on this one witness statement by a guy named Rory Ross who said that he watched Richard shoot Joe Tash with a shotgun and then that Richard made Rory help dispose of the body. And so that was the initial complaint to law enforcement. Law enforcement showed up and arrested Richard. Richard told police that he had spent the night in town because this murder took place at a campsite. And we're talking pretty rural Montana, all of this. This town is a town of about 100 people. And that he had stayed in town with another individual named Rick Scarborough, who denied that. And the brother of Rick Scarborough is the one who provided this 38-page affidavit indicating that Rick had confessed to him that he had essentially framed Richard and been part of a cover-up, and that he had knowledge of another cover-up or another murder that was orchestrated by these same people.
What was this other murder?
That was a murder where the brother of Rick Scarborough, Tom Scarborough, and Tom Scarborough's wife, Amy Scarborough, again, had two out-of-state people that they had become friendly with and had ripped them off for drugs and money, both of which were involved in Richard's case as well, specifically drugs, which we can get into in a minute. But this other murder took place about 11 months prior, and they had killed one out-of-state person. The other out-of-state person had heard the murder and fled, so they didn't get the second guy. And initially, the thought was that they were going to pin it on him, just like they pinned Joe's death on Richard. That didn't happen. In that case, Tom and Amy Scarborough both ended up convicted. Rick Scarborough did end up actually being charged in that case, was at first convicted, appealed, overturned the conviction, and I do not know why off the top of my head, and then was acquitted on retrial.
So you're thinking that it was the plan from the start to frame Richard?
That's certainly our argument.
Where'd they find him after this happened?
By him, you mean?
The actual killer.
Rory?
Yes, Rory.
Rory had, after the alleged body disposal, had fled to a gentleman's house across a creek, and from there they called 911. And so he met with investigators in the early morning after the murder. But yeah, like we said, they didn't take the clothes he was wearing. They were covered in blood. They didn't fingerprint the gun. They didn't do GSR residue. There is one other piece of evidence that did implicate Richard initially, although we've since shown it's bullshit. Pardon me. There were two witnesses at a different campsite that claimed that they heard Richard at the campsite. And this is a quote, hooting and hollering. And they identified his voice from, you know, several hundred yards away through the woods in the middle of the night from drunken hooting and hollering.
Did they know Richard? Did they know what his hooting and hollering would sound like?
Well, they'd met him in social conversations, you know, but not that they could identify, we would argue. And in fact, as part of the post-conviction process, we had an expert. He's an ear witness identification expert and essentially said that this identification is highly, highly suspect.
Did you think that Rory had done it when the cops came to get you? What was your first thought?
Yeah, I mean, Rory or Rick, they've got priors on this kind of behavior. And it's crazy because growing up, I always thought I was a good judge of character and I could spot out some sleazy dudes like this. But my sleazy dude detector was broken and I admit it, you know.
Would you have called them friends or?
No, they weren't friends. They were just acquaintances.
How long had you been in the Trout Creek area?
Like 4 months. So it was kind of weird. I mean, if I'd have known they were involved in another homicide in the next county over 6, 7, 8 months before I got there, I wouldn't have been, you know, associating with them.
So what was their theory for why you would have done this?
They just ran with what Rory said. And then when Rick said I didn't spend the night at his house, they just ran with it and just kept it alive.
But presumably you would have needed a reason to do this.
Tell her the motive that they argued.
Oh, yeah. Rory said that I was out at the camp and I asked Joe for a joint. And he wouldn't give me a joint.
That sounds like a really good reason to kill someone.
18 years, best friend. Plus there was all kinds of weed out there. You know what I mean?
So it wasn't just they wouldn't give you weed. It's that he wouldn't like politely hand it over.
Yeah, something like that.
And you were annoyed that you had to stand up and get your own?
Right, that's what he was saying. Hey, you know what's interesting, and sometimes I dwell on this fact, and I did for a long time. amongst other things, there was a whole bunch of weird trial things that went down that were super questionable. And the funny thing is, four of them didn't make it in the transcripts. So we tried to get the paper tapes within the time frame that it's mandatory that they keep them, and nobody could procure them.
Did you ever get them?
No, they never got the paper tapes.
They were destroyed at some point prior to the requests.
We're in the middle of that right now for Joey's case. And I was talking to someone else just this morning in a different case about the guy she knows claims that some things were said in court that don't show up in the transcripts themselves.
You know, much like what I'm hearing about Joey's case, not so much in Adnan's, but at least in the ones that we've talked about, these are rural, small town places. I mean, the court reporter in our case had been the official court reporter for this particular judge for many years, was dependent on this judge for their livelihood. And so there has been an allegation that it was deliberately destroyed to protect the judge, because one of the allegations in the PCR petition was a bogus dynamite instruction where the judge said they were deadlocked in Richard's case, 7-5. And they came back and said, you know, we can't reach a verdict. He gave them a dynamite instruction, and the dynamite instruction included language that if they didn't reach a verdict, the county couldn't afford a retrial. But that is conspicuously missing from the transcript, although there were, in the end, about 11 affidavits we obtained from people that were either jurors on the case or witnesses to the dynamite instruction, including a sheriff's deputy that was in the courtroom. But yeah, it's completely missing from the transcript. The regular Allen instruction is, but the part about the cost is missing.
So a dynamite instruction is what happens when a jury can't reach an agreement?
Yeah, exactly. And there are permissible ways to do it, Allen being the primary example, an Allen charge. You know, that it is your duty to consider the evidence, but you can't tell a jury that they have to reach a verdict, and you can't tell a jury that there's anything that's going to happen if they don't. And, you know, this, he basically said, you have to go reach a verdict, because if you don't, it's going to cost the county too much money. Surprisingly enough, the district court in the PCR case dismissed that claim on summary judgment, which I was a little disappointed about.
That seems kind of black and white if you could prove it.
The funny thing is, one of the jury four person, she gave us an affidavit about that dynamite instruction. Not only did she give us an affidavit, but she went further and stated it was a topic of discussion in the jury room. And then what's even crazier than that, in my mind, is in 2001, we had an affidavit from a guy with his parents there, with some investigators my sister hired, saying that they heard Detective Perry Mock over the police radio saying that they have the killer and he's changing out of wet, bloody clothing. And that affidavit was in my post-conviction, my first post-conviction request, but I was 2 weeks late over some time issue, and the district court judge wouldn't listen to it, then the Supreme Court ran with it, and they wouldn't look at it, although they mentioned it briefly, and they said basically the evidence was overwhelming, so they don't have to look at it, or there's no need to look at it, basically.
I hate that word, overwhelming. It's their get-out-of-jail-free card.
In his first PCR, he missed the filing deadline by a couple weeks. District court didn't even consider it, said, you know, you'd missed your deadline. Supreme Court agreed and said he was procedurally barred, and then took the extra step in pure dicta to start talking about how the facts of this case were overwhelming anyway. So they had already said they weren't going to consider it. Then they said, even though we're not going to consider it, there's overwhelming evidence of guilt here. And that's where they referenced this completely misread in the transcript, which we got our district court judge to fix in our case. But yeah, they said that these ear witnesses actually saw him drive away, not that they heard his voice. I mean, it's a pretty big difference.
So obviously you had a lot of possible claims pursued on appeal, but it sounds like a trial, things were going at least at first in your favor. Who was your attorney for that part of the proceeding? And I mean, if you had seven jurors on your side out of 12, he couldn't have been doing too badly.
There was four instances, and a dynamite instruction was one of them. I got into prison litigation while I was locked up, so I know a little bit about the law now. And now I would have walked out of the courtroom during my trial in the first 2 minutes of the proceeding with things that went down. The jury was prejudiced in less than 2 minutes on the opening statement by the state. And Slomsky, who was the prosecutor for Sanders County, says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we're not going to be seeking the death penalty in this case. I was facing the death penalty up until 3 weeks before my trial. So he tells the jury that, and the judge blows up, gets bright, beet red, almost foaming at the mouth, and yells, I'll be the one to decide punishment in my courtroom. So right then, he predisposed me to guilt with a jury. And I was reading the book Actual Innocence by Barry Scheck, and them dropping death penalty charge right before trial is a tactic they use to coerce the jury, or not coerce them maybe, but predispose them to not being so critical of acquitting somebody because of the heavy penalty. And it was weird when I was reading that book, there was like three things in that book that exactly happened at my trial. I mean, the state had the assistant attorney general's office, the county attorney, and the head investigator detective. They all three had big boxes of files, and they were all the same stuff. And that's another thing that was in that book that they said, it makes the jury think, oh, they've got all this evidence against this guy. I'm over there at the other table with my attorney, one little old box, and it's kind of a psychological tactic, I think.
You know, there's actually a case I'm working on right now where that scenario happened with the DA running in and saying, wait, we're not making this a death penalty case. And it hadn't actually occurred to me that that might have been very, very intentional.
They read that book, Actual Innocence, it's right in there. When I read it, I was like, wow. So it must be known in a fairly wide circle in the legal profession.
Were you optimistic, Richard, going in to the trial?
Oh, yeah. My family came up from California, and we had the local bar/restaurant reserved for the after trial party. So we were confident that I was going home. You know, during the trial, they tried to motion and eliminate the Lake County homicide stuff to not contaminate the jury with that stuff. But they somehow got some of that in. And when the attorney general, Joe Thagard, he was assistant attorney general, special prosecutor, he basically ran the case. He's rehabilitating Rick Scarborough on the stand, right? And he presented something to the jury via Rick Scarborough that never made it in the transcripts. He intentionally asked Mr. Scarborough, well, in fact, Mr. Scarborough, were you ever charged with the Lake County homicide? Yeah, he said, were you ever charged that? And he goes, no. And he goes, well, in fact, are you even under investigation for that homicide? He goes, no. And everybody that knew anything in that courtroom, which was about a half a dozen people, knew that he was under investigation, including Joe Thagard, who intentionally misled the jury about that.
That's that other homicide that we talked about earlier.
Double homicide?
Well, it only ended up being one guy. Because
the other way, yeah.
The reason this is important is because they attempted to bolster Rick Scarborough's credibility in Richard's case by saying, now you're not even suspect in that other case. Well, 2 weeks after sentencing,
right.
In Richard's case, they actually charged Rick Scarborough.
9 days.
And although we're not counsel in that case, they definitely knew he was a suspect at the time they misled the jury. That was a claim as well. Although we couldn't really do much with it.
Brett, what was your sense of his trial attorney's performance?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to fault him because they didn't know what we know today. And looking through hindsight, there's about 1,000 things that we would have done differently. But yeah, at the time, he did what he could. The real problem in the trial was that Richard was out of state, the victim was out of state, and the two guys that, you know, we allege and I think at this point have successfully convinced a good amount of people framed him were both local guys, you know, and at this point, this is kind of the start of where they became scumbags. Their histories, even after this, just get worse. But, you know, at this point, they're local people with a local jury. I think that had a lot to do with it. Richard had some issues on direct. The prosecutors baited him into getting emotional. And, you know, I'm sure that didn't help. With the information that he knew at the time, it's really tough to fault him in any specific way. There were some things that happened at the underlying trial that just didn't get handled properly, though. One of which is, and I'll let Richard tell you about, the first Roy Ross confession.
Oh, yeah. In that affidavit I was referring to earlier in 2001, this local guy said that while the trial was going on, somehow he and this Roy Ross were in the county's attorney's office, I guess discussing trial strategy and what they were going to, the state was going to ask them to say or whatever. And the county attorney stepped out of the office for a minute to do something. And Roy Ross confessed to Randy Fisher and said, I'm the one who capped Joe, and I finally got the job done. And that was in 97. He was too scared of him to put it in writing until 2001. And that's the affidavit that I tried to use for one of the pieces in my post-conviction in 01 that was late and then the Supreme Court dismissed as well. And then I think even he told Rory he did it again after the trial. And then in 2012, he threatened him at knife point and admitted to it again.
This guy, Randy Fisher, is the person to whom Rory confessed during the time of the underlying trial. He was a witness in the case. And so, I mean, he should have been interviewed more thoroughly, perhaps, but I don't know.
Other than the, I guess, home team advantage, was there any reason you think they were so willing to believe Rory's story?
You know, that's something that we can't find an answer for. I don't know if Richard has any thought. I mean, so just to give you a brief timeline of the night of the murder, Rory, Richard, Joe, the victim, were drinking in a bar in Trout Creek, Montana, and as well as Randy, this witness. At some point, bar closing time, I believe, they decided to take the party to the campsite. And so Randy Fisher got in his own car, and Joe, Richard, and Rory got in Rory's car and started to drive away from the bar. Richard said that just a minute later or so, not very far, a couple hundred yards, he changed his mind and said, actually, I have to work early tomorrow, and so I'm going to get out of the car here and go stay in town. And then they went on to the campsite. And so the guy that Richard spent the night with, Rick Scarborough, told investigators that he had not spent the night there. I'm sure that they got tunnel vision very quickly with a local guy saying, I watched this happen. And then the only witness to the alibi not panning out for Richard. As far as we know, they never considered Rory Ross a suspect.
Do you think that was a mistake?
Yes. In fact, they knew, and because this came out through discovery, and I think even discovery at the underlying trial, the police knew that there was a phone call at, what was it, 5:40 a.m. or something. I don't have the file in front of me, but there was an early morning phone call that took place between Rick Scarborough and Rory Ross the morning of the murder. No one ever questioned them about it. It wasn't brought into the trial. And so that phone call to us is at the latest point in time that they would have concocted this frame. There's no other reason they would be calling each other at that time. I think that Rory was asked about it as his initial thing and just said, well, we're friends. And they left it at that.
When you heard that your alibi was not being supported, what was your reaction?
The whole thing's in disbelief. When they arrested me, I figured I was in jail, right? And I figured, two, 3 days it tops, I'll be out because they'll figure out it wasn't me. And 18 and a half years later, I finally got out. The detective was on the stand, right, Perry Ma? And John Putica goes, whoa, Mr. Mock, how did you exclude Rory Ross from being a suspect? Well, because he goes, you didn't take his clothes at the scene. You didn't test his hands. He goes, how did you exclude him? He goes, oh, well, we interviewed him five times, me and some other officers. And Putica goes, well, in fact, Detective Mock, I have here two interviews here. Isn't it true that he was only interviewed twice? Well, yeah, he was only interviewed twice. So he tries to sell it to the jury that he was interviewed five times. So he gets busted lying on the stand. Then a week or a day or two, I can't remember, after the trial, Perry Mock's on a TV news channel doing an interview with a reporter, and the reporter asks him the same question, Mr. Mock, how did you exclude Rory Ross? And he goes, oh, well, we interviewed him five times. So he's perpetuating the lie to the public to make their case look like, oh, it's golden, you know. That was interesting.
When you were convicted, how long was it until some sort of post-conviction or a direct appeal happened?
Oh, about a year and a half, I think.
So about a year and a half in, you started this post-conviction process, and what happened?
That was a direct appeal, actually. The direct appeal got squashed, and then we asked for a rehearing. Supreme Court denied that, and then we did the post-conviction, and that's the one I was 2 weeks late on.
So how'd that happen, that you were 2 weeks late? Did you have an attorney?
An attorney did some work on it and got it to me, sent it to me in prison, and I sent it in, and it happened to me 2 weeks late. So I got burnt.
Did he tell you about the deadlines or?
No, I didn't really even have to think about it because I thought the attorney was on it and had it under control, you know, but it wasn't. But anyway, so I'm in prison, and for the first year I read about 300 cases. I was trying to figure out how to prove I was innocent and, you know, get a new trial or whatever it took to get out. But it was pretty over my head. So I concentrated on prison litigation, civil rights, conditions of confinement and stuff. And luckily, I ran into the Innocence Project and Tip and Bewley Law Firm. Brett here taking this thing home.
Holidays almost here, you don't have time to go to the post office. There's the traffic, the parking, the hassle. Plus, it'll be packed with everyone mailing holiday gifts and packages. So do what I do. Use Stamps.com instead. With Stamps.com, you can avoid all the hassle of going to the post office during the busy holiday season. Everything you do at the post office, you can do right from your desk. You can buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer. You can print postage for any letter or package the instant you need it. Then the mailman picks it up. It's so easy and convenient. I use stamps.com and my job as associate dean to send out articles. I use it for Undisclosed to get documents for a case I'm preparing for early next year. And I use it in my personal life to send off letters and packages. And you should too. Right now, it's the ideal time to sign up for stamps.com and use my promo code Undisclosed for this special offer. It's a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Undisclosed. That's stamps.com. Enter Undisclosed.
How did you get involved?
The Montana Innocence Project was founded by a good friend of mine and a former state senator in 2008. And so I was aware that there was going to be a project up and running. And because I was good friends with them, you know, I let them know that when they got to litigation, if they needed my help, I would definitely help. And I did some smaller stuff. And then when Richard's petition got filed, you know, they realized that they weren't going to be able to do it with just in-house counsel. At that point, they had just a staff attorney. Just one person that was doing all screening and litigation. And so I came on as co-counsel and did the bulk of the litigation for them. And I got on the case in late 2012. They filed the initial petition in August of 2011. That's how I got on board, just as a pro bono attorney with some connections to the people that worked there.
When you were looking at the files, how long did it take you to reach a decision for yourself? Okay, yeah, this guy's probably innocent.
Well, Richard probably isn't going to want to hear this, but that wasn't something that I really did. I didn't make a determination of my own. I just took the evidence as it is and saw what issues would be available and moved forward from there. Obviously, in the course of things, I became pretty personally convinced, but, you know, just an advocate to start with, trying to help out some people that needed help. The files were, you know, I mean, there's, I think, 6 banker's boxes of files. It took quite a while to get through just to figure out what issues we have. Thankfully, by the time I got on board, they'd already filed the petition. And so my job was really just to litigate the case. And I think that's why I was able just to step in and be more of an advocate than a true believer at the beginning. But it wasn't too long until I became a true believer. I think the first time I reviewed the affidavit from the sheriff's deputy that led to our Brady violation, I said, okay, well, obviously this is the strongest evidence I've ever seen of the evidence is completely supporting Richard's alibi. Richard's alibi, as you might remember, is that he got out of the car just a couple hundred yards from the bar. The Rory Ross was driving that car, and he testified 4 separate times at trial that he never stopped the car for any reason whatsoever. But the sheriff's deputy had actually seen the car stop and the dome light go on and the brake lights illuminate exactly where Richard said they stopped. It never made his official report, though, because he didn't know what Richard's alibi was. And so he never knew that it was important.
Did anyone who did know its importance see that or hear about it, though?
Nobody knew about that until 2013, when our investigator, who has since passed away, which is very sad, when he went and interviewed the deputy again, just sort of on a lark, just to make sure every stone was unturned. And he just had the deputy walk him through every second of his night. His testimony at trial ended when he saw the cars drive away, and he was never asked about anything he observed after that. And he didn't know it was important, and so he didn't include it.
And he still remembered it?
He did. And, you know, per the affidavits and his testimony, he testified at our new evidence hearing. He had never been told what the alibi was. Nobody had ever told him why what he saw was important until after he had given his statement. And so it was pretty compelling evidence that this wasn't coached. It wasn't anything other than him just remembering what to him was an innocuous fact, but turned out to be very critical for us.
So, Richard, how did you end up getting in contact with the Innocence Project in Montana?
I saw a little flyer on the library bulletin board. At the time, I was trying to get my poetry career going and write a breakout book and try to make some money to put a legal team together. It was either that or went across an organization that did this kind of work, and that came to fruition first. So I called him up or wrote him a letter, and we started corresponding back in 2009. And then my mom and sister came up to Montana, and they met with the director, the then director, and the legal director of the project while they were coming up to visit me. And they started investigating my case for about two and a half, 3 years. Then they started litigation.
And the reason that the petition was filed the way it was, because a lot of this evidence had become stale for post-conviction reasons. In Montana, post-conviction has to be filed within 1 year of a conviction or within 1 year of the discovery of evidence. And so a lot of this had already been discovered during Richard's first appeal and first PCR. So they didn't have any new issues.
Even though it was found, it was never presented, right?
Right. Yeah. This stuff had been found previously, but there had never been another petition since the one that was procedurally barred. But in 2012, Randy Fisher, he was had an interaction with Rory Ross at a boat ramp in a river in Trout Creek, which is where this murder took place, where Rory Ross again confessed to it.
At knife point.
Yeah.
He said, you ought to be out there floating in the river.
Yeah. And he'd also threatened him at this time for being a snitch, for testifying in Richard's case. But anyway, that confession is what prompted the new petition. And then we kept investigating. And then in 2013, found the deputy's new observations that support his alibi. And that's what ultimately led to the Brady violation.
That 1 year rule is brutal.
Yeah.
It essentially creates a circumstance where you're basically forced, if you get one thing, to rush to the court before you can get more.
And Montana, I'm sure other states too, they only allow you to amend your post-conviction claim once.
So once you find something important, you have 1 year, essentially, to make sure you find everything you can, because otherwise you're screwed.
Yep. And with the deputy's observations, we knew we had a much better chance at the Brady violation. And it, you know, really was just dumb luck that we found it. The investigator, I'm just going to take a minute to talk about him. Our investigator's name was Spencer Vasey. He was started at the project as a journalism student. Our project here is a joint effort between the University of Montana School of Journalism and School of Law. And he was a journalism intern that started working on Richard's case and really just took it. And he did so good, mostly on Richard's case, that they hired him to be the full-time investigator once he graduated from college. And so he did that for a couple years, and he was just tenacious. He never said die, looked everywhere possible. And that's how he found this just really innocuous observation that was very important to us. Unfortunately, last October, he passed away in a climbing accident in Colorado, and he was only 26. And it's a big loss for us personally, but also for the project, because, I mean, he single-handedly found the evidence that freed Richard, and he would have done similar in other cases, too. And it's a big loss for us.
Yeah.
Richard, when was the first time after your conviction, during all this process, that you started to think that maybe this time something might happen and you might get out?
Well, I was pretty confident I was going to get out the whole time. I just didn't know how long I'd have to wait to see that day. But I knew it was going to come. And once the project was on it and the evidence just kept building and stacking up, it's a shame we couldn't get those paper tapes because there's some crazy stuff in there. But I had faith and hope the whole time, really. I'm on Team Jesus, so I didn't, you know, get depressed and go into a downward spiral. I studied and educated myself and helped other people and wrote some poetry books. I got a new book out. It's designed to thwart the suicide monster in our veteran population. It's called Fishers of Trout and Men. It's a 250-page poetry collection using mystical Christianity, ancient wisdom teachings, trout fishing, and military situations to get guys thinking about bigger and better things about life and perhaps the afterlife and stuff to get them back on track, especially for the guys that have seen a lot of combat. I wrote that in prison, and I just got it out about 2 months ago, published it.
What was your experience like being in prison and being innocent? Did you tell people about it, or did you?
Everybody knew. Everybody knew I was innocent. The first year I was kind of mad, actually. I hate to admit it, but I was pissed off. And it took about a year for me not to be so mad. So then I just kept positive and kept busy, you know, reading, studying, helping people.
Talk about the community in prison that you were a part of.
Well, I happened to be the inmate liaison with the administration for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years with the upper administration. And then I had been a unit representative several times for a year or more at a time. So I was a vocal prison advocate, litigator, complaint filer, and general pain in the ass to the Department of Corrections legal team.
And yet they fought so hard to keep you there.
I know. Yeah, it's crazy. I got 100 pounds of exhibits, grievances, complaints to the Montana Department of Labor and Industry, Montana Board of Medical Examiners, Human Rights Bureau, Montana Medical Legal Panel. They actually changed the law in Montana because of me. No longer can inmates bring a Montana Medical Legal Panel complaint to them, which is required to sue a doctor for malpractice in Montana. So I don't know how that's going to play out. But it was because I had a two-hour hearing in the prison parole room one day with the panel, three lawyers and three doctors. There are two doctors, lawyer, and their investigator, and we had a little mini trial. And when they left, it wasn't looking so good for the doctors. So I had a pretty good thorn in their side the whole time. Luckily, my sister's an attorney in California, and she kind of had my back. She'd write the lieutenant governor or DOC director. So then I'd have a lawsuit going. They send me to another prison somewhere to try to moot the lawsuit. That usually didn't work. But then I had some crazy rulings by judges, and the Supreme Court lost an appeal on a prison suit, and just some crazy stuff.
And you did these yourself?
Yeah. I'm a jailhouse lawyer, kind of. But then I hang out with these real lawyers, and I know I'm not that smart. But in there, I was kind of smart.
So part of why we're doing this now is because actually Brett reached out to me quite a while back now. I don't really remember when. Shortly after you first got news that they'd overturned the conviction. But we were pending for a long time in the hopes that Montana might finally see the light and dismiss the case altogether. And it did. But I remember talking to Brett several times in that period. And he's like, well, nope, they're still going.
They sat on it. The AG's office sat on it for quite a while. But word on the street is the assistant attorney general did his due diligence and read every page of the transcripts. And I guess that does take a while. Plus, he's a pretty busy guy. So at least he wasn't vindictive and malicious and wanted to keep a bogus conviction going. Like I saw on so many horror stories on. I used to watch death row stories on CNN when they came out. And I saw some of the guys in there where it was obvious that they had nothing to do with it. But the state would still press on and overlook all this obvious stuff. And I was glad it didn't happen in my case, you know.
Yeah, Richard's actually been more stressed since he's been out of custody than, you know, the times we'd visit him and talk to him in prison, you know, before his conviction was overturned. But, you know, I mean, we have to give credit where credit's due. Mark Fowler of the Montana AG's office took a long time to decide if they were going to follow through with the appeal or not. Now, of course, they filed the appeal the day Richard walked out of custody. In fact, we had just had a little press conference outside to announce that he'd been released. And, you know, that's where we got the pictures of him walking out of custody and seeing his family for the first time in 18 years in person. And then about 3 minutes later, the county attorney hands me a notice of appeal. So they obviously had some interest in doing it up front because they did it the same day. But, you know, it took him from December 4th of last year until August 25th of this year to decide to walk away from the appeal. He said he read every single page in the underlying trial and PCR, and that is thousands of pages. So, you know, to his credit, he did the due diligence needed and came to the conclusion there wasn't anything to overturn. And we're happy about that. We were prepared for a trial. We were not going to lose this one, I'll tell you that.
Did you have more ammo this time around or more than what was shown in the PCR proceedings?
Yeah, I mean, most of it did come out in PCR. There are a few errant witnesses that we couldn't get in. But yeah, there were some more evidence. But the real interesting thing, and I think this is important, is in the PCR briefing, you know, when we're arguing to the court about whether the judge should grant it. And, you know, we had three claims in our PCR petition. We had a Brady claim that was based on Deputy Wayne Abbey's observations supporting Richard's alibi. We had a Schlupp gateway claim to get to the dynamite jury instruction. Now, that got dismissed in pretrial briefing. And then our third claim was a new evidence claim under Montana's new evidence law. And, you know, just like, I mean, you're obviously familiar with new evidence laws. And so we had the evidence supporting our new evidence claim were two witnesses that were neighbors of Rick Scarborough that observed some things that supported Richard's claim that, you know, Rick must have done this in some way. Then we had the ear witness testimony, expert saying that this testimony wouldn't have been available in the same way in 1998. And so my opinion now is new. And then we had the confession at the boat ramp in 2012 from Rory Ross. And then we also had Wayne Abbey's testimony here because in addition to being a Brady violation just for failing to disclose, his observations straight up support Richard's alibi. So that's new evidence as well. So most of it did come out. But in that process of new evidence, specifically regarding the confession, the state argued that essentially you can't believe Rory Ross because he's, quote, the town drunk. And so what they were trying to argue is that Rory Ross may have confessed to killing Joe Tash, but you can't trust that confession because he's a drunk and he has no credibility. But they are, at the same time they're saying this, supporting the conviction that is based essentially solely on Rory Ross's testimony. And so the state wanted to have it both ways. He's credible when he testified that Richard killed the guy, but he's not credible when he says, actually, I killed the guy. And so what happened with him at the new evidence hearings is also kind of interesting. You know, we had subpoenaed him to testify at the hearing, and we're going to try to get into the bottom of what he was going to say. He moved to quash our subpoena about a week before the hearing, essentially saying, you can't make me come because all I'm going to do is plead the fifth. So we fought that, and we successfully fought the quashing, so the subpoena was issued. And he showed up to court and refused to take the stand. And then upon questioning from our judge, admitted that he didn't want to take the stand because he was afraid what he would say would implicate him in a crime or being inculpatory. And so he never testified, but, you know, so he pled the fifth. So if we ended up in a retrial, I was going to do everything I can to exclude him as a witness, or at a minimum, through motions in limine, preclude the state from arguing that he should be believed or should be credible, because in this matter, they made a judicial declaration that he is not credible. So I think that was going to be a big thorn in their sides, and the prosecutor was aware of it because I briefed it. I'd like to think that's one of the reasons they chose to dismiss, but I'm sure it's just that Richard's obviously innocent.
I already know the answer to this, I'm sure, but is there any indication that Montana plans to look into Roy Ross as a suspect in the murder?
Several media people have asked the county attorney if he has any input there. He has refused to comment. I don't know. We have heard nothing. We've had no request for Richard to be a witness in any sort of case. We don't have any information about that. It's been 18 years. My guess is they're probably not going to seek any sort of charges against him, which is really sad for the family of Joe Tash.
Richard, how has Joe's family reacted to all of this?
Well, they're pretty much on my side. One of the brothers, Wayne, he was told by Detective Perry Mock that Richard had Joe's blood on from head to toe. So he was a little upset to begin with, right? But then he sat through the trial and he saw, you know, the whole thing was phony, and he didn't believe I was guilty then. He doesn't believe I'm guilty now. I think he even sent a letter to the judge or something to that effect stating that.
Yeah, we got a letter through the investigative process from Wayne Tash saying, and this is a direct quote, that Richard's conviction is a gross miscarriage of justice.
I mean, I hugged Ed Tash, one of the brothers of Joe, and also a super good friend of mine. So I haven't seen him yet, but I plan on hanging out with him again.
Did the prosecutor here ever try and use the whole justice for the family argument for why your conviction should not be overturned, like in media statements?
No, and I headed that off at the pass pretty quickly, especially on the appeal, by providing that letter from the brother to them to try to show that, you know, if they do the right thing here and walk away from this appeal, they're not going to have an angry victim's family. And so I think that's part of it. Part of the other thing is, as far as I know, the Tash family has never been contacted by anybody on the state side since the post-conviction process started. Every indication to us is they haven't been asked their opinion or have any statements. And I guess I'm basing that mostly off the fact that I was asked by the state if I knew what the victim's family was going to be, or in relation to that letter, that I had the letter and they did not. So I don't think that they were ever even consulted with.
There was a comment earlier about the victim's blood being all over someone's clothes.
That's what he told the Tash brothers, the Tash family.
Was he talking about you?
Well, there's two statements. One was what the detective had told the victim's brother, that Richard was covered in blood, which is patently untrue. Richard was wearing the same clothes he had the night before when he was arrested, and there was no blood on him. The other statement was the one that we referenced earlier, and this is probably what you're talking about, that Rory Ross, when he made contact with law enforcement, he was covered in blood, and the detectives there, the investigators, did not take his clothes.
Did they make note of this? Did they?
Yeah, they did. But his story was that Richard had threatened him and said, Rory, you have to help me dispose of Joe's body. And so that's why he claimed there was blood on his clothes, because he'd helped Richard move the body.
Was the body moved?
Not that I know.
Actually, now that you say that, he was found in the camper still. I don't know if he's found where he was shot. There's another whole side of this that Rory claimed that Richard tried to set the camper on fire to burn the evidence, and that the gun was burned. In a barrel? But you weren't there. You don't know.
They found that gun in the fire that burned.
Yeah. The gun that was used did end up in a fire, which is another thing that Tom Scarborough knew about because Rick Scarborough told him. That's another piece of evidence that we think Rick really did confess to Tom, because Tom knew a bunch of stuff that only somebody involved with the murder would have known. Now, of course, Tom had died in prison, and so we're stuck with these statements. One was a notarized statement, and one was a sworn statement to an investigator, but those were also time barred. That's a perfect example. That evidence was obtained years ago, but never made a PCR petition, and so we couldn't use it in our new evidence petition because it was more than a year old.
So this case has been going on since, what, 2011 you filed a petition? And we're sitting here, and only in late 2016 are you finally getting the, not just the overturned conviction, but the state's finally decided, okay, no, we're not going to move forward here. Why so long?
These things just take a lot of time and resources. Montanus' project at the time they took Richard's case was one person. It was the founding executive director who did everything. Now there's an executive director, a legal director, a staff attorney, communications director, as well as an entire network of volunteers. And a lot of that network was put in place for cases like Richard's, one of the very first cases we started. And so we had to get people on board. Getting the facts to even make the PCR claim took a long time and took a lot of resources. And almost everybody was volunteer. We've been using the number about 3,000 hours of volunteer hours went into Richard's case in terms of journalists doing research, my time,
investigators, out-of-state trips,
expert witnesses. And so there's a lot of volunteer hours here, and that just takes time. But then once the petition is actually filed, you know, there was initially a fight about whether Richard would even be entitled to a hearing. And then the judge ordered a hearing, and then both sides had pretrial motions. We moved for summary judgment on Brady. They moved to exclude our expert witness under Daubert. So then there was a summary judgment and expert witness hearing. And then there's about a 7-month delay from that until the new evidence hearing. And the new evidence hearing took place in December of 2014. September of 2014, there was additional post-hearing briefing order. And then we got our decision overturning the conviction in November of 2015. So, I mean, a lot of that time is just the judge waiting. And then there's an additional 7 or now 8 months between the time they filed the appeal and the time they dismissed the appeal. So, yeah, the average time per the project anyway, from the time somebody writes to them and says, I'm an innocent guy in prison, I need help, to the time that an exoneration happens is about 7 years, give or take.
So now that you can leave Montana, what are your plans?
I'm going to try to get my writing career off the beaten path into the mainstream. Maybe some poetry mentor work with veterans, do some other intellectual property things that I created in prison that I had no luck doing from in there, you know. So my hindrances are down and my rights are less chilled now, so I can try to make some things happen. Well, I'm just glad to be out and starting my life over. And I'm 50, so I've got a couple years left in me.
How old were you when you went in?
31.
Yeah, it was pretty special. Richard's birthday is in February, right?
Yeah.
That he got released in December, so we got to celebrate his 50th birthday out of custody.
Yeah.
It was a pretty special time.
What'd you do your first day out?
First day out, we went and had some pizza, and then my legal team had set me up in a nice little apartment. So we came here, and then my sister came up from California, and I had some people donate some money to help set my apartment up even more than my lawyers did. So I had a pretty good little base of operations to start getting back into the swing of things.
We're just really happy that Richard's case turned out the way it did, obviously, and also for other people that are still in prison, that the conversation on post-conviction relief and actual innocence, wrongful conviction, is finally happening, in part to the great work you guys have done. You know, getting it into the public vernacular is a big accomplishment. And I really hope the momentum keeps going, because, you know, Richard's case is important and we did a great job and we're really happy about it. But there are a lot of other people that don't have the resources we had to use for Richard. And so we got to keep that conversation going. You got a poem?
Yeah, let me read you the first poem in my book. It's called Fishers of Trout and Man, off the title. In city dreams of rivers near or far, tossing and turning, blinded by unearthly star, Every color of his rainbow holds encounters unbeknownst to mortal men guarded by a heavenly host. Caught between worlds of darkness and light, we offer good words, always fighting the good fight. From time immemorial, for at least 2,000 years, those like us, as well as those of our kind, speak few words, and fewer words still speak. For it is one's destiny, then, to lead by example, being both fishers of trout and men.
At a press conference in August, after Montana announced that it would be dropping all charges against Richard, Brett said, "This case is unfortunately not that unique. These kinds of things happen way more often than we like to think about, and we're finally getting this into the public conversation. Thank you for being here to be a part of it and getting word out about Richard, his story, and ultimately the problems in our criminal justice system." To listeners of Undisclosed, it won't come as a surprise that stories like Richard's aren't unique, but I'd like to echo Brett in thanking all of you for listening to Richard's story, and all the ones like it, both in this podcast and through other coverage of criminal justice issues. It may seem like a small thing, but being part of this conversation on criminal justice reform is a huge deal. It will ensure that stories like Richard's aren't forgotten, and that our legal system will be able to continue to learn from the mistakes of its past.
Wraps up a very special bonus episode of the Undisclosed Podcast. Listeners, thank you for coming along for the ride. Also, thank you for the donations to the Georgia Innocence Project. They have been deluged with love in the form of text donations. Y'all have been very cool about that, but we encourage you to keep on giving. Every cent counts. So we want to help them raise as much money as possible. Here's how you do it. Pick up your phone, open your little text app, and press the numbers 91999. That's who you're texting. And what I want you to text is Joey. You do that, you're gonna get a link that directs you to a donation website where you're gonna be able to give some money. I'm encouraging you to donate $5 unless you're super rich, in which case I'm encouraging you to donate $500,000. That'd be cool, but unrealistic. So let's stick with $5 or above. If you're feeling super generous because, you know, we're approaching the holiday season and it's the time to feel those things, consider giving 10, 20, 30, 50. Again, every little cent counts because every little cent goes towards fighting the good fight in Georgia and overturning wrongful convictions. You've answered the call thus far, and we are so grateful to you for doing so. Thanks, listeners. And now on to the credits. As always, our most special thanks go to the good folks of the Georgia Innocence Project. Learn more at www.georgiainnocenceproject.org. Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. She produces the show and she gets help from Hannah McCarthy and Brooke Giddings of the Actual Innocence Podcast. Methyl Telhan is the super producer that pulls this whole thing together. Methyl still finds a way to call the shots from international time zones unknown. Methyl, we miss you. Please come back and save me. Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez did our theme song, Baluki on our logo, Christy Williams and Nina Moose are on our website. Besides our website, and y'all know this, we got the social medias. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's on the Twitters, the Facebooks, the Instagrams. We's all over the social media, so get at us and keep the conversation going using #Undisclosed, #JoeyWatkins, #JusticeForJoey. Or if you want to get a question read on the Undisclosed Addendum hosted by John Cryer and debuting on Thursdays at 6 p.m. EST, tweet him a question at Mr. John Cryer using the #UDAddendum. If you've got a good question, maybe, just maybe, he'll read it on the show. Lastly and leastly, your executive producer of Undisclosed is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward for seeing you next week for another episode. Until then,